Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Kamala Harris is San Francisco's district attorney. She was elected in 2007 when she ran unopposed for district attorney, and New York Times listed her as among the 17 women most likely to become female president of the United States. She got her law degree from Hastings. National Urban League named her Woman of Power, and she received a Thurgood Marshall Award from the National Black Prosecutors Association. She's now running for the Democratic nomination for the California Attorney General and has written with Joan O.C. Hamilton a book, Smart on Crime, Kamala Harris.
Good morning, Marty.
Hey, I'm from New York. You can take the Bronx out of the boy. You can't the Bronx out of the boy.
It's never coming off, right?
No, it's not on there. All right, tell me something I don't know about being a DA.
What you don't know about being a DA is that there is a lot that you have to focus on that is beyond the public view, that is about detail, and it's about the law, and it's about really just taking seriously the power of the job and making sure that you're principled and you're following the ethical and legal rules so that you can do the right thing and do justice. You know, a lot of people think they understand what it means to be DA because they're bombarded with information about that because it's on the, you know, it's the subject of their favorite television series.
Exactly.
But there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. That is what some might consider to be the mundane, but actually critical to doing the good work.
Good. Now, you mentioned details and important things behind this. What are some of those details? What are some of those behind the scenes things?
Legal research. You know, I am often involved in conversations with my attorneys about, okay, what does the law, what does case precedent tell us so that we can go into court with a piece of evidence that we think is admissible and argue why it should come in. And it's not going to be just because we say so. It's going to be because there actually is a foundation on which we work that is centuries of interpretation of what we do to do justice.
Tell me one more thing that most of the public who's just watching Law and Order has no idea what a DA is really being, what it's really like to be a DA.
It's grueling work in very dire circumstances. When I was elected DA in 2004, January of 2004 in San Francisco, two-thirds of my lawyers did not have email.
Well.
Right? When you pull back, and I think that's actually a statement about just what is probably a very obsolete condition that we're in law enforcement and in government. You know, San Francisco is a world-class city. Two-thirds of my lawyers don't have email in 2004 when our first cousin is Silicon Valley.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is.
It's unbelievable. So use the word grueling. That's different than people having email. Paint a picture for us about maybe something specific that brings to life the grueling nature
sure.
of it.
Well, I work and my lawyers work in a building that is called the Hall of Justice in San Francisco.
Right.
And I refer to that building for many reasons as the most horribly wonderful building in town. Some people affectionately refer to it as Beirut West. But I actually started a law clerk program, and when I bring them in at the beginning of the summer, I ask them to go across the street and stand in front of the bail bondsman's offices and look at the front doors of the Hall of Justice, and it is an absolute study in sociology. Because through those doors walks every element of life of our community, from people who are there as jurors, people who are witnesses, victims, defendants, lawyers, cops, judges, people who've had their car towed, all walk through that door. And in that way, it is a great equalizer, I think. And that's what happens in that building. We deal with some of the worst of human behavior, but we also deal with people who have a sense of optimism that the right thing will happen through a process of justice.
What, you use the word grueling, though. That hasn't painted a picture of what grueling, why you feel
grueling.
Grueling
is walking into this building that is, you know, kind of pre-war, not even pre-war, you
right.
know. And it's work, for the lawyers and for the people who work there, it's working under conditions that are not in any way convenient to doing the work. You know, it requires my lawyers to stand at Xerox machines sometimes, you know, 30% of their time just to copy documents because we don't have the appropriate support staff. It means, you know, you should come and visit the place. It means working three, four people in a small office. You know, at one point, not everyone had a computer, and they are working there for hours and hours, 12-hour days is very common, and weekends. And they're trying to find victims, and they're trying to find witnesses, and they're frustrated because cases are delayed or not being processed quickly enough. And that can be grueling. That can be a grueling condition.
You use the term Beirut West to describe the building. Why?
Because it's like a war zone. It can be like a war zone. There are battles being fought there constantly.
What was the biggest battle you recall in your work there that was just, a, you know, like a war zone?
That's a great question. I think that there have been many. I mean, we've dealt with some horrendous cases involving, for example, some of the worst crime that we prosecute is child sexual assault cases.
Oh, yeah,
and
right.
Cases where we have not been able, for example, to bring a victim to court knowing that the defendant did what he did. Mm-hmm. And that can be horrendous, you know, in terms of the frustration that a prosecutor feels when they know that they want to do the right thing. They want to make sure there's a serious consequence for crime, and it can't happen.
You know, you said child sexual assault, and you said he did. And, of course, in the child sexual assaults, we certainly think almost all of those are males. I did read a meta-evaluation, a series of evaluations of domestic violence.
Yeah.
And that actually between 36 and 50%, depending upon which study you read, 36 to 50% of all the severe domestic violence was initiated by the women. Does that surprise you, or is that accurate?
The point that you're raising, which is a very, very significant issue in criminal justice, is that what we do as prosecutors is a function of what's reported.
That's right, the reporting problem.
Right.
Exactly.
And so, for example, I specialized for a while in child sexual assault cases, and it invariably was the case that boys would not report.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And the same is true for domestic violence. There's a stigma associated with a certain person being a victim of a certain kind of crime.
Precisely.
And the same is true also for immigrants. That we see a huge underreporting of cases where an immigrant is a victim because they're afraid of the system, or they think the system will not be supportive of them.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Kamala Harris. She is currently San Francisco District Attorney, running for State Attorney General, and the author of a book called Smart on Crime. What's the best and worst thing about being a DA?
The best thing is when at the end of the day, you know, you did the right thing and there was justice. And I know that sounds corny, but there's nothing like walking into a courtroom, prosecuting a case where you know, and invariably the victims that we have, the victims of crime, are the most vulnerable people in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the people who are often very voiceless because of their condition and circumstance, and also because of the experience they had being a victim of that crime. And when you can give them voice and give them power in that way, it is one of the most satisfying things that
tell
you can
me
do.
One case, one specific case.
I personally prosecuted a case years ago when I was in the Alameda County DA's office that involved a woman who was scalped.
Oh my God.
In fact, I have the distinction
of
having prosecuted what I think has been the only scalping, human scalping.
What does
I'm not talking
mean?
Raiders tickets, right?
Does that mean
tickets,
they just take
right?
the skin of the whole thing? What's a scalping?
Yeah, yeah. Literally. We didn't find the tool, but we believe it was a Ginzu knife. You know,
the commercials. Yeah, right.
But it was a horrendous case. Horrendous.
Yeah, horrendous.
As you can imagine, ooh. Both in terms of the damage done to the victim and just the conduct of the defendant. And the victim was a woman, and the defendant was her off and on again boyfriend. But she, before that, had been living a life where she, you know, she lost everything, and she was just down and out. And then this incident, of course, you know, was, as you can imagine, life-altering. And as a result of the prosecution of that case and the time we spent together and then the support that we were able to give her, at the end of this case, and he was found guilty, at the end of this case, she got her kids back, she got her car back, she got on the right road. And, you know, so when we see people in the criminal justice system, especially as prosecutors, we see them at a real life-altering moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're at a crossroads at that point. And hopefully we can, and often do, put them on a better track or really significantly improve the way that they'll go forward. You know, if we do our job well.
What's the worst thing about being a DA?
Seeing the worst of human behavior. Truly. You are completely 100% all day long surrounded by cases that, you know, are often cases where people abuse people who are in a position of trust, where, you know, you are surrounded by information about predators in our community who take advantage of, for example, the elderly. So it is constantly about, and I try and make this point to my office and to my prosecutors that everyone therefore has to find balance, because we all day long are dealing with some of the worst of human behavior. And in order to prosecute a case well, the lawyer will get very involved in the case. Right. I've done trainings, and I've taught at law schools trial advocacy. And I strongly believe that to do well, you have to imagine yourself there and figure out what actually happened. It's much bigger than what's in a file and on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And so in order to go through that exercise really requires a lot out of the individual.
You describe yourself as an optimist. I would think that if I were in your shoes, mm-hmm. and I was seeing what human behavior can be like, and I've actually just been reading a book about people lying at work, the various kinds of deceptions mm-hmm. and lies, I would think I would get... I'd be very jaundiced. I'd start to become very cynical about people's motives, what they say, you know, mm-hmm. on the entire continuum. Yet you still say you're an optimist. Do you really remain an optimist, or have you been changed as a result of seeing the seamier side of human life?
I'm not an idealist. As a result of maybe seeing what I see,
as your mother would say,
as my mother would say, but I am an optimist because I do realize that bad things happen. But I also have seen in my career that we each as individuals have the power to really improve the condition and lives of other people. And I've seen it in my work as a prosecutor. I've seen it in my work as the elected DA of San Francisco, when I've been able to create, for example, initiatives like Back on Track, focused on 18 through 24-year-old first-time low-level nonviolent drug sales offenders, and combine efforts with the business community and labor and nonprofit organizations to say, let's focus on this population, get them jobs, get them education, and get them, you know, back on a path where they're going to be productive and actually enjoy their life.
Let's say I was listening to Kamala Harris, and I'm a kid. Let's say I'm 18 years old, 20 years old. And I said, I want to be Kamala Harris when I grow up. And so I said, I want to be a district attorney, a really good one. And mm-hmm. I want to be, and I come to you. Mm-hmm. And I do, you know, they always say, go get an informational interview and talk to, mm-hmm. and I managed to somehow get to you.
Mm-hmm. And I actually love to do that. I have so many kids.
But watch that. They're going to, well, if you really want to walk the talk, you're going to give your email address out. And if anybody who's an aspiring DA,
I would love to. Yeah, absolutely.
What is the email address?
Districtattorney@sfgov.org.
Okay. Districtattorney@sfgov.org.
Yep.
If you or someone you love is an aspiring DA and would like some counsel from a preeminent one.
Yes. Okay, so let's put some qualifications on this.
Yes.
The young person has to be a student.
Yes.
And if they're interested in being a DA, they could be in high school or college,
yes,
or law school.
Okay, that's great. That's very generous of you, and a great gift to.
Yeah, I love doing that. I would not be where I am,
right,
were it not for people who really took me on.
Who did? Who was the person who helped you the most?
My mother.
Tell me more.
Oh, she's an extraordinary person. But she passed away this year. But she was the kind of person who really understood, again, the power of the individual and the responsibility that we have to lift people up. You know, my mother's saying to my sister and me was, you may be the first to do many things, but make sure you're not the last.
If your mother was sitting here right now, and what would she say to you as you are now embarking on your run for the Attorney General? What exactly would she say to you?
She would, I mean, she's a fighter. My mother was 5 feet tall and was a phenomenally strong person. And
what would she say to you?
Oh, she'd say, just stay focused and be the best that you can be.
But when she got beyond the cliches, what else would she say to you?
Oh, she'd get into details. I mean, you know, it's funny. I tell people, you know, my mother, when people are thinking about running for office, or even anybody who's trying to aspire to do, you know, more in their career, it's really important to make sure that you have a group of people who are invested in your success.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
really,
and
true.
You need to look for those people
yeah,
if you don't
yeah,
have
yeah.
them.
It's really right.
People who will literally cheerlead and will have the ability to support you
understand
what you're doing also, right?
So
look for those people, because anyone who can actually have the capacity to be that person in your life is someone who, by their very nature, if you ask them, they say yes.
Dear listeners, that's an important takeaway. There's nothing I believe more strongly than that we all need a cheerleader.
Yeah.
I was my wife's cheerleader.
Yeah.
You know, and my wife was just a plain old teacher in an elementary school in New York City in Corona, Queens.
Yeah.
But she had no aspirations to anything.
Yeah.
And I pushed her butt.
Yeah.
And she's now won Superintendent of the Year Award for Northern California.
That's fantastic.
You know, and she's testifying all the time in Sacramento and D.C.
Right.
But she needed a cheerleader. I am a big time when I believe in somebody. I can be a very cynical son of a bitch.
Yeah.
But when I do believe in somebody,
yeah,
I am a big cheerleader.
Yeah.
Dear listeners, there's got to be somebody in your life who's believed in you. Give that person a call, huh? Say hi, huh?
Yeah. That's
I
right.
want to hear a little more details about what your mother would say to you if she went beyond the, be yourself, be, you know, don't be the last one.
Oh, you know, I mean, she believed that you could do anything. My mother was never burdened by role models in terms of, you know, you could only do what you see somebody like you doing. And so her point was always, walk in the room. And know that you belong.
But your father—I mean, your father was a professor at Stanford. Your mother was an East Indian. Yeah, an East Indian who's where the culture is so achievement oriented. So it's easy for her to say, "Be anything you want." What about for African Americans who are more like the folks who are in Oakland, where I live, or in Queens, New York, where I grew up, or whatever? What do you honestly say to those folks?
There are a number of things. So, for example, Marty, I'll share with you a story, which is I always, whenever I can, I go out when I'm asked to speak to students. And several years ago, I would repeatedly go out to, for example, Bayview Hunters Point, which is a community in San Francisco which is socioeconomically poor.
Right.
And I'd go out and speak to predominantly African-American students. And in this particular time, I remember they were probably like 14 years old. And I was talking with them about my education. And I said, so I went to Howard University, and I wanted to make it interesting and fun for them. So I said, so every Friday, for example, at Howard, we'd go up on this place called The Yard, which is on the middle of campus, and it's this huge square block covered with grass in the middle of campus. And we'd all get dressed up, and the girls and the guys, and it would be time to flirt and music, and everyone would hang out on The Yard Fridays at noon. And I'd look at these kids, and I'd say, and they all look like you, and they're all college students. And these kids would look at me with a blank stare. Now, I know if I said a prison yard, there may have been more of an association. It was horrible, and it made me so upset. So actually, I was honored at Howard University a few months later, and I spoke with the president of the school, and I told him the story, and I said, could you give me some yearbooks? Howard yearbooks, and he sent me a huge box. And after that, every time I'd go out, I'd take them the yearbook. And it became one of the most popular things, and I'd leave it for them. Because thousands of pages where they could see young people that look exactly like them, who are on the swimming club and the chess club and the homecoming queen and the debate team, and thousands of pages, literally. And it had such a remarkable influence on them. So that's just the beginning point, which is the influence that you can have on a child is also just exposing that young person to what they can be, with an assumption that they've not necessarily seen it, and their own imagination may not actually allow them to see it.
This is the first place I'm going to disagree with you, and I'm hoping you're going to listen to me in this. This is important.
Yep.
I have spent my life kind of studying what are the best post-secondary paths for people.
Mm-hmm.
This is what my PhD is in. This is what I know. We send too many students to college.
I know where you're going, and I don't disagree
with
you.
I'm going to lay it out, though, for the audience.
Yeah.
Now, I do not believe that even in Bayview Hunter's Point, that kids do not see college as an option. In fact, that's all they ever hear, is that college is the only way. In fact, the reality is we have students who are even pretty darn good students who graduate from college. And remember, if you have below 1,000 SAT score and you graduate in the bottom 40% of your class, your chances of graduating, even if you're given 8.5 years, are only 1/3. Mm-hmm. Most of them are unemployed, huge student debt, and have no employable skills. But the Kamala Harrises of the world, because it worked for you, because you were the son of a daughter of an endocrinologist and a very bright mom, assume if it worked for you, it's going to work for them.
No. So here's where I'm going to tell you you're wrong.
Okay.
And you can look at what I've done. So I created Back on Track. Okay, this initiative focused on the 18 through 24-year-old first-time low-level nonviolent drug sales offender. Why that group? Because when I was in college at Howard, we were all 18 through 24, and we were called college kids.
Right.
But when you're in the system and you turn 18, you're considered to be an adult, period, without any regard to the fact that that's the very phase of life in which we have invested billions of dollars in this world in places called colleges and universities, knowing that's the prime phase of life during which you develop and mold a human being to be a productive adult. So, in creating this, one of the main partners has been the building trades, the plumbers, the carpenters.
Critical.
And we have enrolled them in pre-apprenticeship programs.
Critical.
I agree with you completely. Give people skills so that they can earn a living wage and raise their families and feel that they are being productive. And it does not have to be college. My point earlier was simply expand the possible opportunities for these kids so they know what they can be. And any one of those is good, and I don't judge it at all.
The irony is that the same people who are most concerned about the kids of Bayview Hunters Point and talk about celebrating diversity are insisting on one-size-fits-all education, where everybody is prepared in a college preparatory track, even if they're not academically oriented. I know it. I live it. That's my wife as superintendent faces all the time. The pressures that if you say that there's going to be different paths, they're called tracking. It's racist. It's anti-African-American. They're going to be dumped.
No,
that's what I'm hearing all the time.
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, I don't agree with that perspective. I agree with you that we have to be dedicated to recognizing that each one of these communities is as diverse as any other, meaning there will be in every community those who have creative skills, those who have the skills to use their hands to build, those who have the skills to be an intellectual and explore what can be through engineering and science. And these communities are as diverse as any other, and we should put resources in those communities recognizing that and basically seeing people through a prism instead of through a plate glass window.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Kamala Harris. She is San Francisco's district attorney, the leading candidate for not only the Democratic nomination, but the odds-on favorite to win.
With a lot of work. And I hope all of you are voting. Please vote for me.
you are getting a pretty damn good look at Kamala Harris here, much better than the sound bites you're going to get. I'm going to keep her on for the whole hour. Do you mind staying for the whole hour?
Sure, but I'm going to have to rearrange the next half hour.
Yeah, but I think this is and this may even be a good MP3 for you to be using, because I think this is a really broad picture of you. This is very good. Anyway, she's also the author of a book called Smart on Crime. Let's go back to I had asked you if I am a college student or a high school student, and I'd like to eventually become Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
What other advice do you have? What map out the game plan for me.
Okay, so I'm going to repeat myself because it's so significant and important. Mm-hmm. Identify the people in your life who are your cheerleaders, and if you don't have those people, go out and find them. And it can be a teacher, it can be someone where you pray, it can be a neighbor. It can be the police officer on the corner who you know. It does not have to, you know, not all of us are fortunate enough to be born into families where that's there. And that's okay. That you don't have to decide, okay, I don't have it because it did not come to me naturally or I wasn't born into it. If you don't have it, recognize you don't have it and go seek it and find it.
You know,
but the cheerleader piece is absolutely significant.
I agree with you that it's significant. And we all tend to generalize from our own life. I never had cheerleaders because I am an intense, aggressive, argumentative guy and not handsome.
However, I bet you did and you just didn't realize
it. Well, I'll tell you. But I really was one of those guys who had to fight like hell by myself because nobody, even when I got into graduate school at Berkeley, it wasn't with any cheerleaders. They didn't like me because I was a pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. I am a pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether or not somebody's got a cheerleader, if somebody wanted to be Kamala Harris and DA, what advice do you have for them?
So
how to make the most of law college,
yeah,
law
well,
school,
first, you know,
getting
you,
into the
you've
system?
You've got to be you've got to be the best that you can be, because the world in life is competitive. Everybody has to fight on some level or another and to a different degree. But all of us have to fight. I've fought for what I have. And so you have to, one, appreciate the fact that to become successful means to endure and survive a competitive process. And so be prepared for that as well. And, you know, there's this saying, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game, right? So just recognize that the game requires you to be competitive. And, you know, one of the things that my mother taught us is that you have to have a code. And you need to create your code and decide what your values and what's important to you. You know, to be honest, to be loyal, to whatever. And stick by that code. Because, you know, the bottom line is that you can walk into a party and be the most popular person, but it doesn't necessarily mean anybody trusts you. And so that is part of it. And the other part of it that I often say, in particular when I talk with women's groups and professional associations, is don't be naive to believe if you're the best, that should be enough for you to succeed. There is, as you get older and you achieve professional success, every work environment has its politics. And you need to learn the rules of that. And then you can decide what part of it you like or can accept and that part that goes against your code. And if it goes against your code, don't do it. But don't be so naive as to say, I'm not going to play the politics and expect that you're going to succeed.
You know, you say that when you particularly talk to women's groups, but I got to say to you that I have found that women and very often minorities, when they're in positions of power, are more exclusionary than even the old boys white network was today, at least in 2000. I'm a career counselor in my private practice, and I have the benefit of confidentiality. Mm-hmm. And I swear to you that in the confidentiality of my office, I have many executives and nonprofit leaders, etc., that most of the white males are eager to hire a fully competent, equally hardworking woman or minority.
Yeah.
But when I talk to my women or minority clients who are in positions of power, they are about sisters helping sisters, and they're about minorities helping minorities. They are the New Girls Network is more exclusionary than the white boys.
That is not at all true. The reality of it also is that we cannot and should not presuppose that all things are equal right now, because they're not. I gave the commencement speech at Hastings a few years ago, and of the hundreds of kids that walked across the stage, less than a dozen were African American. You can look at who are in the top law firms in the city who are partners and then managing partners, and there are very few. There are still great disparities in our system.
And does disparity...
And so, one of the things that we know is that, you know, these things don't have to be mutually exclusive, but the reality is that when someone is a minority, meaning they are one of a very few in a large group, okay, and that can be because they're a woman, it could be because they're ethnically or racially a minority in that situation, they will want to know that they are that they have role models. They will want to know that people who have had the same experience will reach out to them and share those experiences. But you know, back to the piece about the mentorship, for example, seek out some of my greatest mentors have been straight white men.
So that's my point.
So yeah, and I agree with you about that. These things, one is not to the exclusion of the other, but I still do absolutely go and talk to women's groups about what it means and what we can do to feel comfortable in the workplace and feel comfortable with our success and strive for success.
Implicit in what you're saying is that disparate impact comes from this cabal of white males who are tamping down women and minorities. Is there not a tremendous danger in endangering meritocracy even more than it already is by using, for example, the legal theory of disparate impact to justify that, like in New Haven versus Ricci, you know, that in fact that is a priori evidence of unfair treatment of minorities?
I'm going to start from the premise that we have in our society, unfortunately, still great disparities.
Disparities, yes. Caused by racism, in your judgment?
Well, caused by a number of factors. I'll give you an example of one disparity that I think is and should be shocking and intolerable. Of all African-American and Latino ninth graders today in California, less than half will graduate.
I understand.
High school.
Terrible.
And if you walk into the county jail or the state prison, you'll see those numbers reflected.
And is that result of racism?
Now, let's talk about the causes.
Right.
Okay, so for example, one of the areas of focus for me that I talk about in the book is I think that one of the biggest issues that we could address that would deal with disparities and also would provide us with just a better society is to deal with elementary school truancy. Okay. Now, that seems like a small issue, but let me tell you. I focused on the fact that I was concerned and questioned who were our homicide victims in San Francisco who were under the age of 25 when they were killed. And I learned that 94% of them were high school dropouts. Then I went over to the school district and asked what's going on. And of the few number of kids that we have in the San Francisco public school system, 5,500 had been designated as habitually and chronically truant. And of that number, 2,400 are elementary school students. And when I'm talking about habitually and chronically truant, Marty, I'm talking about cases involving a sixth grader who has missed 50, 60 days of a 180-day school year.
What gives you the sense that there are many what are called covariates? There are factors that are all correlated with each other. Clearly, people who drop out also have problems, home lives. They come from the inner city. They're more likely to have all kinds of other problems. What makes you believe that a core to reducing crime rate or crime victimization rate is the truancy problem?
Because if you just look at one discrete factor, that is almost a complete indication of who will invariably be the high school dropout, the victim of crime, and the perpetrator of crime. It is elementary school truancy.
I heard you, but that's correlative. I could equally pick poverty. If I could say...
Yeah, no, but here's the thing. Here, I have adopted, and I've, first of all, let me just be very clear. I do not plan on ending world hunger. Okay. That's not. I'm not promising that. It's actually not my intention. I actually figured this out. It took me a little bit, but I figured it out after all the bruises on my forehead from knocking my head against the wall. Mm-hmm. I can't fix everything, so I have embraced this concept of triage.
Right. We have to.
Remember MASH, the soldiers are coming on the helicopter. Hawkeye's there. The surgical tent is over to his right. He's only got so many pints of blood, only
exactly.
So many surgeons.
Exactly.
And all those souls are important that are coming in on that helicopter.
Right.
But some aren't going to make it in the tent.
Exactly.
Because you got to start somewhere and fix something.
Exactly.
So I'm telling you that if you look at one specific issue, like elementary school truancy, we would have a profound impact on the amount of public resources we're putting into treating that person or dealing with that person for a lifetime.
You're telling me that. What's the evidence of that?
The evidence is the initiative that I've created. And the evidence, a number of things. University of California, Santa Barbara just issued a study last month. The cost to California of truancy on an annual basis is $1.1 billion, billion with a B. The associated costs are upwards of $20 billion a year when you take into account all of the other social services that have to go into addressing that person and medical services and so on. So it's costing us a lot. It is also costing us a lot in terms of the criminal justice system and therefore public safety. And I've given you the example of that in terms of just what I've figured out about who our homicide victims are. And by the way, anecdotally, we know our perpetrators of homicides come from that same demographic.
Let's broaden to the whole issue of after-the-fact prison reform. You are known primarily for somebody who's trying to move toward more rehabilitation efforts and less punitive approaches.
But I'm going to correct you there.
Okay.
It's not one to the exclusion of the other. I'm not saying people should not be punished for crime. They should. Mm-hmm. In fact, I very much feel that part of what will happen if we're smarter on crime is that we'll recognize that when... We do have to react swiftly and with certainty after a crime has been committed. There needs to be accountability and consequence when someone commits a crime. What I'm focused on is after that person has been appropriately punished, what are we doing with them? And in that way, we have to recognize that if we don't focus on their reentry into our society, they will commit another crime, and that's a problem. In California, for example, on an annual basis, we release 120,000 prisoners because they've served their time. Within 3 years of their release, 70% recidivate,
exactly.
Reoffend. It's the highest recidivism rate in the country.
Exactly.
So my focus is on that issue, recidivism.
Right.
And reducing recidivism.
As I understand it, there have, you know, this, you're not new at this. I mean, this is not a new concept, the
right.
idea of, you know, reentry programs. And we've been funding anti-recidivism programs for decades. And in as I the statistics I read, that 62% are back in 1 year. So there are job training programs. There are literacy
training. No, they're not. And I will tell you the distinction that I see between what's happened in the last 10 years and now is that law enforcement has to lead this initiative as much as anybody. And what has been happening, I went out and talked to a group of foundation people in Chicago a couple of years ago who have been funding reentry initiatives, to your point, for years.
Right.
And they're doing good work, well-intentioned, but law enforcement's not at the table. And
but they're doing it and it's not reducing results, so why would bringing law enforcement to the table be of such great added value that, let's say, I my heart is always with the working class and middle class person who's struggling to pay the rent.
Yeah.
And you've got to look him or her in the eye and say, I want to take more of your tax dollars to pay for more reentry programs. We've been doing it for a long time, and but we're going to bring law enforcement to the table now, and it's going to make the difference.
First of all, it's not about bringing new resources to the table. It's about a distribution of existing resources in a smarter way.
Yeah, you said bring law enforcement to the table. What do you mean?
So, for example, in the book, the first half of the book, I talk about what I think are myths in the criminal justice system. And in the second half of the book, I talk about best practices and models throughout the country, all of which are law enforcement led by a DA, a sheriff, a police chief. Okay? And what you will see is that if there is better coordination, And there is collaboration around recognizing, for example, that we want to use the carrot and sticks of law enforcement. So on my truancy initiative, I created a truancy court. We also created a reentry court. So enter now into the whole mix. Yeah, we want you to now get that kid to go to school more, or we want you to now go to the apprenticeship program that the carpenters have enrolled you in.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to also have to go every other week and report to a judge, you know, that person with that black robe who's going to say to you, if you're messing up, you might go back to jail. And so whereas grandma or good community-based foundation says, you know, Johnny, go do the right thing, I'm saying, Johnny, go do the right thing, and if you don't, you might end up in jail. It's an incredible incentive.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Kamala Harris. She is the author of Smart on Crime. She is San Francisco's district attorney and the odds-on favorite to be the state attorney general. I would, you know, they have these online betting things like InTrade. I think it's called InTrade.com. It's based in Ireland where betting is legal or whatever, or in Antigua or something like that. And if I were to bet, I would bet a lot of money that Kamala Harris is going to be our state attorney. What can I tell you? You see, I call him as I call him. You know, if I agree with you, I agree with you. It's a good thing, you know.
Well, then you can boast after it's all done.
That's right. I will. But then again, I predicted that Hillary Clinton was going to be president, so what do I know?
So this is, I'm doomed.
Anyway, I was a drug counselor in the in Corona, Queens, where my wife.
Mm-hmm.
I know. You know, I grew up in the Bronx. I was born in the Bronx to immigrant parents. Mm-hmm. I grew up in 6 years under the elevated trains.
Yeah.
I was there. Mm-hmm. I'm a white guy, but I was mm-hmm. there, and I can hear a drug dealer telling me this: "Hell with trying to land some straight job. I probably can't even get it. People even with college degrees, they can't find a decent job or any job. I sell drugs. I'm making more than people with masks." I don't mean to use the accent, but it's the concept. I'll drop the accent because that's probably racist. I'm making more than most people with master's degrees, and my chances of getting caught are tiny. 95% of felonies don't result in an arrest, let alone a conviction. Worst case, if I get caught, I'm only going to get a year or three in a prison. That's no biggie. TV, exercise, good health care, all a gift from the taxpayer. Not so bad. How would you try to convince me when I'm out of prison?
You're delusional. You're delusional. The fact is, you're not making any money when you're selling drugs. Did you read Freakonomics? I mean, it was, they embedded a guy who ended up, you know, being trusted by the drug dealers dealing drugs out of an apartment building. And so he just stayed with them and hung out with them for months and watched the books and kept the books. And for all of their busy, busy little activities, selling a couple of rocks and a few rocks on the corner, they were averaging about $2 an hour. With no health benefits, with no retirement, they are delusional. because they are going to buy a little bling from time to time does not making that mean they are making more money than the carpenter or the plumber or the accountant. They're not. And so part of it, so for example, in our Back on Track initiative, we bring them in for sessions. One of the sessions is just that conversation where we actually outline to them and let them see that in reality, they're actually on the losing end anyway.
So who's making the millions of dollars? There's a lot of money being spent. This
not
is
these guys.
Billion.
Not these guys who are dealing drugs on the corner and who are occupying the bulk of our criminal justice system.
Six other Democratic candidates have announced they're running against you. How would you be different from them? Now I'm being typical political type interviewer since we have you here. You are
yes.
running for office.
Yes, I am.
How would you be different from those other six Democratic candidates in the way you'd function as Attorney General?
Well, to the extent I know who they are and know about them, and I don't know a lot about them, and I don't know any of them really well, but the distinction that I believe that is clear is that I have actually done this work. I'm going into my seventh year as the elected district attorney of San Francisco. So I am the chief elected law enforcement officer of a major city in this country, and I've been running a public law office for almost 7 years. And I understand the responsibility and the challenges. And that relates to everything from creating efficiency around, again, the mundane issues like building a professional office, to the importance of creating initiatives and being dedicated to innovation, even though there is an assumption of risk that when you create something new, it may not work the first time. I understand the importance of also realizing that there are a lot of responsibilities and there are going to be many balls in the air and we've got to juggle them. So, for example, I have in my office a whole, you know, units that are directed to the crime that you see on television every night, but I also have developed and created units around high-tech crimes and crimes against the elderly and environmental issues because we need to always think about how we're going to be relevant and expand, and these efforts can coexist. So I've done this work. And
I think that's inarguable. I think that, you know, I'll push back when I can, but I think that's a fair statement. I think nobody's running against you, has your experience. I want to turn to the fact that four of the six Democratic candidates are Latino, and they would argue that with Latinos being the largest minority, the fastest growing minority, and with so many Latinos in California prisons, that it would be a good thing to have a Latino attorney general. How would you respond?
I think it would be a good thing to have a Latino attorney general. I agree with that. It would be also good to have a woman. It would be good to have an African-American. It would be good to have an Asian. It would be good to have a white guy, of course. The most important issue is who's qualified to do the job and who will do the job the right way.
But they're going to say, you know, given that the Latinos are the largest largest minority and the fastest growing minority, so many Latinos in California prisons, that means that they have a better understanding of the issues and that they should therefore, you know, unlike, you know, other a white male or a woman or an African American, would be a better attorney general at this point in time.
I think the point that would be most significant is that we want in our elected leaders to have people who are understanding of the communities we represent and will reflect their priorities. And, you know, I just had my Latino kickoff for my AG campaign in Los Angeles a few weeks ago. And Dolores Huerta, who is an icon in the labor movement and a hero, really, was one of the hosts of the event. And there is a broad base of support from the Latino community because I believe I can show through my life's work a real dedication to that community, among others. And, you know, it is my priority to, of course, take seriously the fact that we have in the criminal justice system a disproportionately large number of Latinos and blacks who are victims of crime as well as perpetrators and will be impacted by a lot of the work that we do as an attorney general's office.
You know, earlier you talked about the issues of the disparate impact is something that you pay attention to. I mean, I think our race consciousness and our ethnicity consciousness in determining who we vote for, it is true that 95% of blacks voted for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
We I am upset. You know, we all have our core things, our hot buttons. Mine is meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be the first mm-hmm. to fight in the 50s or in the early 60s, you know, when there really was gross, and earlier, of course, prejudice against minorities mm-hmm. and restrictions on women. I'd be the first to fight against the mm-hmm. Old Boys Network. But I worry at this point in 2009, 50 years after the civil rights movement began, that we are so damn race and ethnicity, in terms of who we vote for, in terms of who we select, we want our workplaces to look like. I am worried as hell about that. I want Kamala Harris not to be judged as half African American, half East Indian. I am trying to judge. I am, you know, we're all judging mm-hmm. Kamala Harris right now as this human being. And do you not worry that this ethnocentric consciousness that we have created in our colleges and our schools and our media ultimately disserves meritocracy and therefore the largest good, the common good?
But I don't agree with your premise.
Okay.
I think that we have a continuing work to do to be more aware of the various cultures that coexist in our society as a country. And there is nothing wrong with celebrating the history of those communities and being aware of those communities and who they are. And that does not have to be to the exclusion of also believing and fighting for the idea that the best person should do the job, regardless of what they look like, what faith they practice, what you know, language was spoken by their grandparents.
I think there is a terrible side effect of celebrating your hyphenated self, whether it be a Polish American or Jewish American or Black American or Latino American. It does tend to create this balkanization of mind, this sense of paranoia about what people, when you fail, that it's because you're a woman or you're Black or you're, that is the most disempowering thing when we, I, you know,
well,
I,
we're talking about two different things.
Well, you're I think it's critical that we are world citizens and view ourselves that way, not as celebrating our group, what the achievements were of past African Americans or past Jews or past whatever, are really essentially fairly irrelevant to what we are going to do in our lives, that we, as you were saying, have to work like crazy, find cheerleaders, do all those things.
But I disagree with you. Okay. And I'll give you as an example. You know, somebody actually who just called me recently, Elie Wiesel, the great professor and Holocaust survivor, has dedicated his life to sharing one of the darkest points in the history of mankind in a way that is not just about talking about the past, but he does it because he wants to make sure we never tolerate that kind of thing happening again. And I agree with that. I agree that we should always talk about the history of slavery in this country so that we can just remember what happened not so long ago and dedicate ourselves to making sure it does not happen again to whomever. And in that way, we are just acknowledging our history, and it is not about doing that to say that we should be exclusionary or that there should be, you know, that we should not come together as a whole community, as a universe, you know, and to as a world community, to your point.
I am a child of Holocaust survivors.
Right.
And actually, I decry the endless efforts of the Holocaust remembrance groups. Hmm. In the same way as I decry the people who are continuing to hearken back to the lessons of slavery. We all know the lessons of slavery. I think it does create bitterness, paranoia. I am eager, so eager, to help people develop self-esteem based on the legitimate what of what they earn, not because of their ethnicity, not because I'm Jewish, not because I don't want to be paranoid. You know how many...
Marty, we're not working from a clean slate. You can't deny that. We're not working from a clean slate. We are not working on a clean slate. The slate was not clean the day you were born, erasing the experience of your parents. It exists.
But the price is too great.
And the impact of that experience exists.
When you spend time focusing on that, the negative side effect of creating externalization of responsibility, blaming victimhood, etc., is so profound. And
it shouldn't be at any extreme. I agree with you. It should not be the only
How many times have I heard people blame their problems because of their background and denying of their responsibility in it? The fact that their six generations ago their grandparents were enslaved is not why I got robbed at knife point in an ATM by an African American. It wasn't institutional racism.
I don't think any reasonable person would justify someone robbing you because their family was born into slavery.
In every university in America, especially my alma mater, Berkeley, they will always say that we must contextualize. Contextualize is the word that's always used. And so these disproportionate crime rates, etc., are a function of the being oppressed, the legacy of slavery. I think that ultimately it doesn't do any group of service, whether it be Holocaust survivors, children thereof, African Americans, or whatever. I worry terribly about the ethnocentrism. We need less pluribus and we need more unum, as far as I'm concerned.
I think that in order for us to ever, if we want to get into a conversation about history or sociology, or we always have to understand that nobody. My mother used to have the saying, "Nobody, you didn't just fall out of a coconut tree."
I understand.
Right? We all exist in a context, and when we are engaged in a certain analysis about who an individual is, the conversation will be about talking about who that individual is in the context of their experience. Then there's a different conversation we have when someone has robbed another human being. Then it's another saying my mother had. There may be 1,000 reasons why one man kills the other man. The man is still dead. Right? So each of these coexist. So if we're having a conversation about Johnny Smith and he robbed you, then I don't really care about what his parents or his childhood involved. He robbed you. It's a crime. He needs to be punished. And so, you know, one does not exist to the exclusion of the other in terms of the conversation and a sensitivity and awareness about the need to have each of those conversations, but in different contexts.
You talk about the importance of context. But if you look at poor people and the contexts in which they grow up, mm-hmm. Their context, all they ever see is poverty, low achievement, drugs, single-parent families, violence, etc. It seems to me that to transcend one's context, to transcend the area around the coconut tree, one must stop thinking about your context and instead think about what can I do to move forward?
That's a nice bootstrap analysis, but here's the thing. I'll give you another example of an initiative I started that I talk about in the book also, which is this. Children who are growing up in a community where there's a great deal of violence or in a home where there's domestic violence invariably suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. There is trauma that is literally, and it's physiological, right? It's not just psychological. And we have to recognize that that is happening and intervene. Because if we don't, that person will at best be self-destructive, but probably destructive of their community. And so I'm talking about the kid who goes to sleep every other night not knowing if daddy's going to start, you know, just beating the stuff out of mom. They can't predict when it's going to happen. It's about the child going to sleep at night who's 7 years old who hears gunfire every night and probably has a relative who has been killed. The trauma that child is experiencing is not going to go away, and the impact and the effects of that are not going to go away if we don't intervene. Now, that's about looking at the child in the context of their experience and recognizing that that will have an impact on who that person becomes. And when I say self-destructive, it means that they're probably going to self-medicate, because every normal human being can only put up with and deal with so much trauma before they try and figure out a way to escape. So then you look at rates of alcoholism, you look at rates of substance abuse, and all of the other issues. So when I'm talking about that individual in this way, I'm stepping back and assuming what I think is my role as leadership to recognize causal connections. And in that way, I am advocating the need to see the connections, which are very clear, and let's intervene using the public health model. right? Which simply tells us if an epidemic has taken on, the best thing to do is to first do prevention, then early intervention. If we're doing treatment, it's too late. Now, am I going to give that guy an excuse when he commits a serious and violent crime for that trauma he faced as a child? No. But looking at it as a problem as opposed to a case.
Somebody listening to this, first of all, I want to do our listeners, let our listeners know for one last time here. I am talking with Kamala Harris here, Kamala Harris on Work with Marty Nemko. She is a San Francisco District Attorney. She is running for Attorney General and is the author of a book, Smart on Crime. I think that if somebody had tuned in without my having just said that, they would have said, gee, I'm talking to somebody who is the head of Health and Human Services. Is there a legitimate argument that, I guess maybe what I'll do is to explain this. There was a critique of you in Wikipedia, which is a kind of a collection of, basically, the collective wisdom of the world. It's got more accuracy than most encyclopedia, most individual journalists who have their biases. I actually really like Wikipedia. But it goes to that point that you are more of a social service advocate than an attorney general.
Absolutely not. Listen, let me tell you something.
Well, let me read you first, and then I want you to comment.
I know what you're going to say.
But they don't.
Okay, go ahead.
The Wikipedia profile says, Ms. Harris, who critics often label as soft on crime,
which is not true,
has come under, well, great, I definitely want you to respond, has come under fire for not seeking the death penalty in cases where the law indicates it's appropriate, as well as for drug diversion programs, which accepted illegal alien felons for job training when such persons couldn't legally hold jobs in the United States. This came to light when one program client, Alexander Isagiri, allegedly grabbed a woman's purse and attempted to run her over in the process of his getaway. San Francisco still has the lowest incarceration rate in the state of California. Harris has also faced criticism in the face of continuing poor relations with the police and rising violent crime rates. And so now, how would you respond?
Okay, so first of all, since I've been District Attorney of San Francisco, we have increased the conviction rates to the highest they've been in under 15 years.
But it's still the lowest.
They are the highest. We're talking about my priorities, you're asking me about my priorities, and so I'm sharing those with you. Okay. Serious and violent crime has been at the top of my list of priorities. And so that is why we have increased the conviction rates to the highest that they've been in almost 15 years. We have sent twice as many serious and violent felons to state prison. I created a gun policy, and under that policy, we've increased the conviction rate for gun crime from 43% to over 90%. And I have supported in my candidacy for Attorney General by some of the leaders in law enforcement, including Bill Bratton, who just left the L.A. Police Department, but before that headed New York and Boston's police departments. My police chief, George Gascon, just endorsed me. The police chief of San Diego, Lansdowne, endorsed me. I have been elected to be on the board of the California DA's Association, and I was elected by my colleagues to be a vice president of the National DA's Association. Now, let me tell you something, Marty. These people are not supporting me because I'm soft on crime. Quite the contrary. What they want and what we all want is to know that we are not approaching the criminal justice system and policy in a way that is just confined to these two ridiculous, simplistic categories, which is you're either tough on crime or you're soft on crime. And that's why I wrote the book. Let's be smart on crime. Let's crack down on serious and violent crime and make sure people go to prison for a long time. But let's also recognize that to focus on prevention of crime is also a smart way to go, coexisting with the prosecution piece, if we really want public safety. And so that's my purpose, and it may be a model that people aren't used to, but there's no question that we've been tough on crime.
Kamala Harris has been Kamala Harris. Boy, I can't get it out.
It's okay, calm. Just think calm.
At least you get it. At least you get the name repeated many times. Kamala Harris has been my guest for the entire hour here on Work with Marty Nemko. Her book is Smart on Crime: A Career Prosecutor's Plan to Make Us Safer. I really hope you've gotten a really good feel for the woman that you're going to be probably voting for, I'm guessing.
Hopefully.
And it has been a pleasure having you as my guest.
Thank you, Marty. It's been great to be here.
I'm glad. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will talk with A.J. Jacobs. He's the author of Guinea Pig Diaries, My Life as an Experiment. He's outsourced as many of his life's tasks as he could to India. He's read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. He attempted to follow the Bible's teachings literally, and he saw a bit of what it's like to be a woman, actually, by signing up on MASH.com as a woman. Fascinating guy. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us. growth among those who don't.